Okay, so this is a Blackboard lecture, and David gave me a strict injunction not to use any fancy slides, so I'm going to violate that injunction midway through, just to keep your attention. So let me just start. What I'll talk about today are the programs, our program and the themes within the program and how they connect up. The way I think that this broad program is joined up are by the concepts of climate models and climate sensitivity. So that's the title, Climate Models and Climate Sensitivity. And I always tell my students, you know, if you can't read my writing, just raise your hand and say, that's illegible. Okay. As David said, it's a broad program, and what we're dealing with are three themes that all have to do with something called Earth System Science, which is a term that some people don't really like, but I think it is a necessary term. So let me talk about the Earth system just really briefly. So this is a schematic of the Earth system. Okay. So if you were trying to build a model of everything to do with climate and the biosphere and everything, what would it look like? Well, it would have, you could put boxes, okay. I'm going to make a three-box model. Maybe I'll do it over here. Three boxes, okay. One box would be the atmosphere. Now, that's where I live. That's where I do most of my work, okay. There's something called the top of the atmosphere, TOA. That's where radiation from the sun comes in and radiation emitted from the Earth goes out. You could have another box. We could split that up between land and ocean. Okay. All right. And then underneath, we'd have some box for the geosphere, for the solid Earth. And we talk about processes that run between these boxes and fluxes and transports between them. So one set of components. Actually, it's kind of hard to figure out how to draw this in a two-dimensional space. It's a kind of interesting topology problem. But if I sort of draw a box that kind of joins them between, we could add two more components, okay? The biosphere, bio, and the cryosphere, which is land ice and sea ice, glaciers and sea ice, all right? And they're sort of coupling the atmosphere, land and ocean, and so it's good to sort of put this box, overlay that box on top of everything. So these are the components of the Earth system, and then you can talk about processes or things that are transferred back and forth between these different components. So I'll just write that over here. So you can think of various things, such as radiation, for example. So I mentioned solar radiation. Incoming solar radiation is insolation. So we can call that this rad. Okay, what else can we think of? Well, I deal with atmospheric circulation, so we could think of winds and heat and work that are done through fluid dynamics, transport, things like that. So, and that also happens in the ocean. In fact, you could have momentum transport from the atmosphere to the ocean all the way to the bottom of the ocean. And there's, of course, interactions between the atmosphere and the land. So let's just put circulation here. And that's just a shorthand for everything involved with wind and currents. And a big part of this whole picture, which I think couples just about everything, in fact, you can take it all the way down to the geosphere, is water. So I'll just call that H2O. Okay, all forms of water, certainly the solid water that's in the cryosphere, but water vapor, liquid water is a big process. And then we should add to this carbon dioxide, CO2, all other biogeochemical processes that couple these different Earth system components through chemistry. Okay, and carbon dioxide is a big part of this. Now, I'm not going to do the next obvious thing, which would be to join up all these boxes and arrows with more arrows, okay? You just have to take for granted that all these things are coupled together. And traditionally or historically, we've made tons of progress in these fields by basically not ignoring, this is sometimes a mischaracterization, that the atmospheric people ignore the ocean or the biospheric people ignore the atmosphere. But you take all the other components as given outside your system, and you work within your system. So you'll have people working on the ecology, you'll have biologists working in this part, you'll have people dealing with atmospheric circulation. And that's led to a lot of, that reductionist approach has led to a lot of progress, of course. This is the way we've learned a lot about our current state of the atmosphere and a climate system. But that approach has limitations, right? We can't understand the past evolution and future evolution of the climate system without really dealing with some of these tough links. Okay. So this is our Physics of Climate Change program. Okay, that's the name of the program, and it involves three themes. Well, let me talk about the context first. The context is really the thing that makes this urgent, as David said, is global warming. The fact that we're continuing to emit large amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So we're now at roughly 380 parts per million versus the 250 parts per million of CO2 or greenhouse gas equivalent that existed pre-industrially. We've seen about a degree of warming. Okay. So the context is really global warming, and I think one key parameter that would join up all these Earth system components is the idea of the climate sensitivity parameter. Okay. You ask what we're all interested in as Earth system process people. Not the only thing, and this is certainly not the whole field, but one key parameter would be the rate of change of temperature with respect to the concentration of carbon dioxide. And I'm going to put an R here. That R indicates radiative equilibrium. And I'll talk about that more precisely later on. Now, this CO2 here, what this is not really the concentration of CO2. It's actually what it means is the log to the base 2 of CO2. The way people define climate sensitivity is the rate of change of TS, which is the surface temperature, globally averaged surface temperature, per doubling of CO2. So log 2 concentration of CO2 is a natural unit. Okay. And the reason we use that definition is that the radiative forcing from CO2 is logarithmic in the concentration. And so as we increase as we emit more and more gases exponentially, greenhouse gases exponentially, fortunately for us, the radiative forcing, the climate impact of that, is only linear in the log of the in the rate of increase. Okay, are there any questions so far? All right. So we have three themes in this program. Okay, for this physics of climate change. First is macro turbulence. Okay, and what that has to do with is the general circulation of the atmosphere. It's kind of this. Let me just draw very, very rough bubbles around my processes here. So macro turbulence is the large-scale atmospheric circulation and ocean circulation. We don't have much on the ocean in this particular program, but that's what it would encompass in my mind. This is a player in climate sensitivity, but it sort of sets the stage for the climate sensitivity question. Real players in the climate sensitivity business are clouds. Okay, and the third thing we have is ecology. Okay, so clouds are part of the atmospheric component, I would say. They couple radiation, water vapor, circulation. And they have a lot of uncertainty in this particular parameter associated with them. But I would say that uncertainty has been quantified. Okay, I hate to use Rumsfeldian language, okay, but it's actually becoming more popular. There are known unknowns and unknown unknowns. All right. I would say that clouds represent a known unknown. In other words, we don't have the final answer, but we know which processes we have to study to understand the role of clouds in climate sensitivity in this parameter. Okay, but for ecology, it's a different story. So the ecology is what couples the carbon cycle here to biology. Okay, I'm drawing a kind of loose bubble that goes over here. And I would say this represents one of the wild cards, one of the unknown unknowns, where we don't really know how the biosphere will react to a changing climate, and then what that means for further climate change, to the degree to which feedbacks will be positive or negative. And I'll actually write down an expression that we need for what we need to, a formal mathematical expression within its limits of validity that I think capture what we need to actually pin down. Okay, so these are the three themes. And
clouds, you mean aerosol clouds or gaseous clouds,
These are clouds. This is a water vapor clouds.
They're
water clouds, the kind you see. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions?
And ice clouds.
Ice, yeah, water, yeah, in all its phases. Did I say water vapor clouds? Okay, water vapor, liquid water and ice water. So I think that there's expertise in those, in all aspects of clouds within the program. Okay, so this is a kind of ambitious program. Well, how do we talk to each other in these things? Well, I think there are lots of tools. One thing that's changed besides the urgency of the climate problem is the toolkit available to people interested in this whole field. In fact, you can actually study Earth system science, and I think it's a valid discipline because what do we have? Well, what do you need to set up a discipline? You need a scientific discipline. You need data. Okay, you need some sort of modeling and some sort of theory. And I think our toolkit for crosstalk. Yes, it's very interdisciplinary, but there are things where we can meet. And this has certainly been the case of the program that we have, first of all, global data sets that are easily accessible. Okay, it's not universally true that all data in all these areas is easy to access, but really we have a huge amount of satellite data, field campaign data that's being synthesized into large databases, so people can access these. So a typical graduate student postdoc can work with this data, and you can use that data and compare it to quantitative models. So-called general circulation models or Earth system models that try in a very simple way, well, not very simple way, but to the extent possible to capture these various processes and couple them, okay? And here at the PIPP, we have theory that we're starting to develop in these areas, trying to distill the most important elements of these systems. Okay? Now, I can't pretend to be an expert in everything I'm talking about today, but what I will do is try to convey some of these themes and hopefully get at some of the interactions between the different parts of the program and give you something of a unified picture, and hopefully not bite off too much. Yes, there's a question.
Do you need theory to make quantitative models, or is it just purely phenomenological?
Well, if I, you know, I don't like lots of arrows, but we can draw. Oh, don't. I see. That's here. Don't turn off my PowerPoint. Okay. The thing is, yes, this has been drawn with like a triangle. I mean, so I could draw a triangle with this. I'm presenting it here linearly, but of course, theory goes into building the models. But the theory, but a global theory of climate does not help you with building components of climate models typically. Typically, you have to have a good detailed knowledge of specific processes. So that's at least that's the way I see it. Okay. So let me get started on a specific model. Okay, so here's our very first simple climate model. This is not the kind of model you could run some representation of this on a Windows machine or something like that on a personal computer. Okay, so what do we have? Well, here's the Earth. Okay, and this outer shell here is the atmosphere, the way just schematically. Let's here put the sun over here, and it's shining shortwave light. Okay, which I'll call S. So this is visible light. That's the solar flux, so it's going to be in units of watts per meter squared, so the average solar flux seen by the Earth. The wavelength, typically 600 nanometers. Okay. And the Earth is radiating long wave light, infrared radiation, okay, at about 4,000 nanometers for microns, and this is L, long wave, all right, so invisible long wave. And I've drawn a shell around here. This actually represents the atmosphere. Okay. And basic greenhouse effect comes about by the fact that the Earth, the solar radiation penetrates through the Earth's atmosphere, which is transparent to it more or less to first order. Okay. And these arrows back and forth represent the emission from the surface and the back emission from the atmosphere of long wave radiation. And where I've drawn the outer shell, this is a height above the Earth's surface, a radial distance from the center, ZE. Okay, so the ZE is the distance between the surface and the outer rim of this shell. Okay, And so we have a radiative equilibrium that we're going to talk about. So there has to be a balance between the long wave coming out, short wave coming in. And that defines the temperature for you, assuming black body radiation. So you have S equal to L equal to sigma TE to the fourth. TE is an emission temperature. Okay. TE is a temperature at Z equal to ZE. And the flux equal to 240 watts per meter squared, which is the average net solar flux, including the effects of reflection from clouds and the surface. This temperature is 255 K. Okay. Now that's as opposed to the surface temperature. So the surface is here, the solid surface of the Earth. So TS, which is T of Z equal to zero, is 288 Kelvin on average, 15 degrees Celsius. Okay. And the difference between TE and TS is 33 degrees. That's the greenhouse effect. Okay. So the greenhouse effect, TE minus TS, this is the greenhouse effect. But now, does anybody know where ZE is in the atmosphere? You could actually find out. Well, where is the atmospheric temperature? 255. It's about 5 kilometers up. Okay, so halfway up in terms of the mass of the atmosphere. It's about a mid-tropospheric height. So Z is equal to ZE is about 5 kilometers. That's observations. That's something you need to predict with some model. It's not obvious. Okay, so how would we work out where that emission? So this ZE is where typical infrared photons would be emitted to space. And below that level, you can't see if you could only see thermal radiation, you couldn't see the surface, typically. I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. So that's the greenhouse effect, the fact that greenhouse gases here in the atmosphere, all right, I'll talk about those, trap the radiation up to about ZE, and then above that, they emit to space. Okay. So our model for that, a very simple model, is one, and now people in atmospheric science like to plot profiles, so you have Z on the y-axis, temperature on the x-axis, and we have a very simple model for the profile of temperature, okay, and I'm going to say that T is TS minus something called gamma times Z. And gamma, so this is TS right here. Down here, this is called the troposphere. This is called the tropopause. And up here is the stratosphere. And here's the troposphere. We won't worry about the stratosphere much today, except to say that for the first order, gamma is zero there. And gamma is just the slope, minus the slope, the temperature profile, a few degrees Celsius per kilometer. Okay? And the first order, well, why does temperature decrease as you go up in height? Anybody know? Eddies? What? Well, eddies are involved, but what's the adiabat? That actually could have the gas, an ideal gas, be perfectly happy at thermal equilibrium with constant temperature all the way up. So why does the temperature decrease with height? It's the greenhouse effect. Okay, so if you had only thermal radiation from the surface, okay, there's actually the classical calculation. I guess Chandrasekhar is the originator. Okay, so if you had an optically thick atmosphere where below a certain level most of the infrared photons were absorbed, the radiative lapse rate looks something like this. It's some constant times the optical thickness divided by the optical thickness plus some other constant. Okay, so this is a monotonic function of optical thickness. That's proportional to the amount of absorbers you have. All right. And so we have, so this could set up, you could set up a temperature gradient just by radiation alone. Okay? That's at radiative equilibrium, a few assumptions in there. But the point is, of course, that if you increase the optical thickness, that increases the temperature lapse rate, okay? I mean, you get a steeper slope. And what's the problem with that? Can we increase this arbitrarily? Well, no. The answer is no. If you take gamma rad and it becomes greater than some critical value, which is typically, I'm just putting in quotation marks because this is for specifically for a dry ideal gas, it becomes convectively unstable. Okay. So this is a valid solution for the radiative transfer equations, but it's not a dynamically accessible solution for the fluid equations, because after a certain point, if you have too much of too strong a lapse rate, all right, you have too much relatively dense fluid sitting over too much relatively light fluid, and you develop an instability. So the first one that would kick in typically is convective instabilities, but other kinds of instability can kick in. So that's the beginning of the picture of understanding how complicated things can be. All right, we have to come up with a theory in atmospheric science. Okay, so key macro turbulence kind of questions. So this is classical general circulation of the atmosphere type questions. Are things like, you know, what sets gamma? Well, even a simpler one. What sets the climatologically observed surface temperature, the temperature we see from year to year? What sets that? And what sets the lapse rate? Okay, the lapse rate is something you can use as a proxy for stratification, the level at which density decreases with height in the atmosphere is a key parameter. So, what sets gamma? These are the kind of key questions you ask if you're interested in the atmospheric circulation. And then you're getting to climate change. How will this change? How will climate change affect these parameters? Affect gamma and TS. All right, so to this date, even though we've studied the atmosphere for a long time, we don't have an a priori theory for what sets the observed temperature distribution. And let me show you some pictures. Okay. So I'll tell you a little bit about what we know, what we're trying to find out. So this is my little review of the macro turbulence part of the meeting, and then I'll talk about climate sensitivity. Okay, so just a few slides. Hopefully that won't. Now, can you see that? Here, let me. Can we get rid of those lights? Yeah. Just a little bit. Just a minute. Okay. So, all right. So, I actually have some figures showing the surface temperature distribution and so on, but I thought it would waste a bit of time to show that. So, let me just show you the kind of regimes we deal with. In the atmospheric circulation. So this is an infrared cloud image. So this is how I'm violating some of the basic precepts of a blackboard talk. I'm showing a fancy image. And I thought I would try to relate. This is my joke. Okay. So not only that, I'm also using tacky animations. All right. So, okay. We had this LHC conference and the program for the last several weeks. I don't know how many of you are left here. But I sit in my office is really nicely located right next to the tower room, the fishbowl. And so all last week and over the last several weeks, I've been hearing about dynamos and LHC this and that. So I thought, okay, well, let's try to relate to the other programs here. I don't have anything on dynamos, but I did find on Wiki that the LHC beam energy is 700 megajoules. All right, and this is an infrared cloud image. Okay, typical infrared light has energy of 0.3 electron volts. So if you make a unit out of the LHC beam energy, our humble little infrared photons here, look, 7 times 10 to the minus 29 LHCs, it's not very much. But if you add them up, they actually have a pretty big effect. So the infrared flux is 240 watt per meter squared. It's 0.3 micro LHCs per meter squared second. I don't know if this unit will catch on or not in the atmosphere. Okay, well, take everything. All right, so finally, if you add up everything globally, you get 10 to the 11 megawatts, okay, or 200 mega LHCs per second. So that, you know, the atmosphere really, you know, the Earth system really does kick in and beat a man-made machine at some point, but that's what it works for. All right, anyway. That's neither here nor there. All right. Okay, so that's my nod to the other programs. Back to mine. Right, so here we have an infrared cloud image. So you've probably seen these kinds of images before. What did they actually show? Well, they basically show satellite representations of infrared radiance, so subvisible wavelengths of light. And what the kind of structures you see, typically they highlight the high clouds. So here's some high cloud. And you can actually see low clouds. I've labeled some over here. Okay, now if you looked at those with with your eye, you'd actually see the low clouds quite well because they're quite reflective. And that's one of their basic properties for climate sensitivity. And here you have these gaps, these relatively dry regions in the subtropics where you have clear sky conditions. Okay, so that's the cloud properties. But you can also infer a little bit about circulation here. Okay, what does this image tell us about the different regimes of circulation in the atmosphere? Well, we have extratropical macroturbulence and tropical macroturbulence. That's how we divide our field between the extratropics and the tropics. And let me draw a little bit to show you what I mean. All right, so let's take my Earth over here. I'm just going to draw a hemisphere cutaway view. Here's the Earth's rotation. Okay, these are supposed to be hemispheres. All right, this is the radius of the Earth, A. This depth here is just the thickness of the atmosphere, H. Typical scale would be 10 kilometers. Okay, and if you draw a latitude of 30 degrees, okay, that roughly divides the Earth in two, actually. And you have exactly divides the Earth's atmosphere in two. And out here you have a regime called extratropical, outside the tropics. And in here you have a regime called tropical. Okay. And the extratropics, you have very different kinds of motion than you have in the tropics. Okay, let's see if we can pick any of that out from here. So in the tropics, you have these long anisotropic strips of clouds. This represents the so-called intertropical convergence zones. And if you look in more detail, there are dehydrated regions here. So what you're seeing is actually the effect of tropical convection lifting parcels of moisture up, and then in narrow columns, okay, and then then descending in much wider regions. All right, and the flow is highly divergent in these regions. Okay, it's three-dimensional. It's vertically coherent, but quite three-dimensional. Up here in the extratropics, the flow is really different. Okay, the flow tends to be, so if I have a characteristic depth H, length scale L here, the aspect ratio of these motions is small in the extratropics, so the motions are shallow. In the tropics, you tend to see delta equal H over L about 1. Right, so we have a large aspect ratio in the tropics, small in the extratropics. In the extratropics, the Rossby number, which relates the advective time scale, U over L, to the Coriolis frequency. Sorry, this is L over U is the advective time scale, U over L is the advective rate. All right, the Coriolis frequency is 2 times the radial component of the Earth's rotation. So this is typically written this way. And it tends to be much less than 1, which means that these flows in the extratropics are dominated by rotation. And that makes the motions in the extratropics quasi-horizontal, which is another way of saying that the aspect ratio is small. And here the Rossby number is typically order 1. Okay, flow is highly divergent. I can write down F. Yeah, so F is the radial component of the rotation vector. Dollar hat, it's 2 omega sine of latitude. Okay. But that what makes it makes the flow dominated by rotation is the comparison of F to the advective time, advective rate, U over L. Okay. And in these latitudes here, moisture and clouds really control the circulation. There's a big difference between these latitudes and those latitudes. And these latitudes, moisture is playing a leading order role in controlling everything. At these latitudes, moisture is important, but you can actually make a theory for these so-called baroclinic disturbances, okay, that have a typical length scale of a couple of thousand kilometers or a few thousand kilometers that doesn't have any moisture in it at all. And a lot of the cloud patterns you see, I'll show you some animations, just show passive advection of the moisture in cloud field by those eddies. So it's like a qualitatively different type of circulation. Let me show you that. So first of all, I'll show you an example of extratropical macroturbulence. All right. That's a fancy way of saying weather. And this was a very nice animation put together by Mike Wallace, okay, who's at the University of Washington, great observationalist. And what he's done is taken the 500 millibar, so the mid-tropospheric stream flow, and filtered it in a certain way. The shading shows let me start with the contours. Contours show a five-day running mean, and the frame rate here is 1 day. Five-day running mean of the stream flow, okay? And the shading shows the total minus that five-day running mean. So the shading shows the high pass and the contours show the low pass. And you can see these eddy disturbances, okay? These are weather systems, high pressure and low pressure, and being really steered along by the low-frequency flow. Very coherent wave packets. You can do much more quantitative analysis. You see these wave packets propagating along. The phase speed is slower than the group speed. You have coherent, it's not linear, but it's not fully turbulent. It's a coherent, linear, nonlinear kind of behavior that you see in the extratropics.
What are the colors represent?
Pardon me? The colors represent something called, it's a stream flow pattern, but filtered, high pass filtered. So that's why, okay, let me play it again. Or maybe you weren't asking me to play it again, but you're just saying. These colors represent the high pass filtered portion. So this is 3 to 10 day time kind of time scales. And the low pass, which is everything greater than 10 days, is represented by the contours. And you can do this a little more scientifically, but it wouldn't make a difference. It's a very simple way so there's two very distinct types of motion. And the main thing is that these eddies carry a lot of power. So their one mid-latitude weather system gives you 3 giga LHCs, all right? So, but they're the energy containing eddies for the extratropical circulation. That's observations. Yeah, that's the so-called NSEP reanalysis. Yeah. Okay. This animation shows something more characteristic of the tropical circulation. Now you can pick up the frequency here. This is the diurnal cycle you're seeing. Okay. So when Australia goes dark, light, dark, you get 1 day. And this is showing something called the Madden-Julian oscillation. And it's a characteristic propagating pattern of convection in the tropics. And this feature here, you see how it's slowly moving to the east. This is seen, it's a regular pattern. It shows up every year, almost continuously. And radiation and moisture and clouds are a key part of this. You can't explain this without talking about moisture. So to leading order, I just wanted to give you a qualitative sense that up here, it's not that it's dry up here, okay? We have lots of rainstorms and things like that, but the theory is dry, okay? And the eddies set the stratification, okay? The baroclinic weather systems that you can come up with a dry theory, those set the stratification. In the tropics, it's harder because you have to deal with clouds, you have to deal with moisture. It's a different kind of problem. But these two different regimes have to be accounted for to have a complete theory of what the stratification is. Okay, so that's it for the animations for now. No, that's not right. So in the macroturbulence part of the program, we talked about theories for the general circulation, both in the tropics and the extratropics. We talked about clouds both the microphysical properties of clouds, what sets their structure, and the role they play in the general circulation. Okay. Whoa. That's the bad part about this being filmed. You can see flux as well. Okay. So, I hope I've given you some of a sense of the macroturbulence part, but let's get back to climate. And there certainly is a connection. Okay. So, but it is a switching gears. I'll talk about climate feedbacks now. So my disciplinary home is really in what I just described in the atmosphere general circulation. And there are certainly people who are more qualified than me to talk about climate feedbacks, but let's see how it goes. Okay, so let's see if I kept that old diagram. I didn't. Okay, so let's go back to this diagram. Okay, remember this? Here's our tropopause, about 10 kilometers. And here's our emission level, TE. ZE is about 5 kilometers. Okay? And this is the level at which infrared photons are emitted to space, with gamma equal to minus dT dZ. Now we're going to talk about global warming for the first time. So what happens to TE when I double CO2? Anybody? Up, down?
Nothing.
Nothing. Right. Thank you. Good climate person. I should have asked that. Non-program people. Okay, certainly nothing, because TE is set by the solar radiation. It's the emission temperature, all right? So what changes when I double CO2? Well, suppose we fix gamma, all right? So now I've talked about the lapse rate as a great thing to find, but let's just fix gamma, because that's how this theory developed of climate sensitivity. So let's assume the lapse rate doesn't change. It's set by convective processes or something that's outside our immediate interests. Okay. So if we fix gamma, the only thing that can change is the surface temperature, TS, and consequently the emission level. Okay. So the classical picture of what happens during global warming is that TE stays the same. The lapse rate might change, but let's say it doesn't change much. And the emission level goes up. So this becomes ZE plus delta ZE. And this becomes, we started at TS, and now we have TS plus delta TS. Okay? So the key thing is, when I double CO2, suppose we fix gamma, we have to be very careful about what we fix in climate sensitivity analysis. There's the Latin term is ceteris paribus, okay? Anybody know what that means? I looked it up. All other things remaining equal, all right? That's very important. And then you can, once you have that in your head, you can actually do a lot of this climate sensitivity analysis just using standard calculus techniques and variational techniques, okay? So the typical delta ZE that you get when you double CO2 is about 100 meters, all right? So you go from 5 kilometers to, say, 5.1. It's not a big change, right? And that's because doubling CO2 doesn't really change things that much by itself. Okay. So delta ZE is about 100 meters per CO2 doubling. Okay, now I'm going to get a little bit more precise. We talk about radiative equilibrium now. So let's talk about radiative equilibrium. What that means. Okay. So if we define something called R, which is the difference between L and S, all right? So R is the difference between the long wave and the long wave going in, the short wave coming out. And we can just define R to be a function of various parameters. And that's how this business works. For example, we could say R is a function of the surface temperature. We could say it's a function of the lapse rate. We could say it's a function of carbon dioxide, of water vapor, okay? We could add clouds, we could add ice, we could add vegetation. We could add all sorts of things. And this quantity could be the globally averaged R. I'm not going to be very precise, but I will point out certain tricks. And these dependencies could be functional dependencies in the sense of that R depends on the global distribution of TS over all the whole surface. Gamma is a three-dimensional quantity. CO2 tends to be well mixed, but you could think about the spatial distribution of CO2. You have to think about time averages and everything. It's not a trivial game, but there's a precise way of getting at what R actually is and how it depends on these parameters. Okay. So this thought experiment here and this notation can be expressed as follows. We can say, the thought experiment. What did we actually do? Well, we said double CO2 and keep everything else fixed. Okay? So what does that mean? So CO2 goes to CO2 plus delta CO2, so I'm changing CO2. And because I didn't allow gamma to change, that leaves just the surface temperature. Ts goes to Ts plus delta Ts. Okay? And everything else, which I can call E, everything else is fixed. Ceteris paribus. So that little E will just be all the remaining dependencies you want to think about. Okay. Then, what do you do? Well, what you do next is you ask, well, what's the change in R? So delta R under this variation of CO2 and delta TS. So it's R of TS plus delta TS, CO2 plus delta CO2 minus R initially. Okay, classic variational statement. I can expand this one in a Taylor series, assuming the perturbations are small. Okay, thereby hangs a tail. Okay, everybody okay with that? That's plus higher order terms, let's just say approximately. But we certainly know something about R. If we insist that radiative equilibrium is established, all right, and that means that the dust is settled, everything's settled down, all transients have gone away, then this thing has to be zero. So these variations are subject to the constraint that R is fixed, R is zero. Okay, so that means this has to be zero. Okay, and that means that delta TS has to satisfy this. Change in R with respect to CO2 at fixed temperature divided by R at fixed temperature with respect to CO2 times delta CO2. And this ratio of partial derivatives, okay, is the change in temperature with respect to CO2 at fixed R. The minus sign goes away using standard chain rule, times delta CO2. And this makes sense, right? We're talking about the change in temperature at fixed constrained radiative equilibrium. It has to look like that. So it's R and everything else fixed. Okay, put the E back in. This means everything else is fixed. This is the climate sensitivity. Rate of change of surface temperature for doubling of CO2. Now we're in good shape because we actually can calculate these things quite accurately. So, the radiative transfer models, you can actually figure out what the change of long-wave radiation is. So R is L minus S, the change of long-wave radiation with respect to CO2 at fixed temperature. And that's not a physically absurd thing to do at all. You can imagine establishing a thermal equilibrium and changing the amount of CO2 and just seeing what happened to the radiation. And this number is minus 4 watts per meter squared for current conditions. And this is just from Planck feedback, or Planck sigma t to the fourth. This is 4 watts per meter squared per degree Kelvin. Okay, and this guy, so just to say, this is from models, okay, radiative transfer models, and this is from sigma t to the fourth. Okay, these are rough numbers. You can get better than that. But what this tells you is that the rate of change of surface temperature for doubling of CO2 is 1 Kelvin. We can call this, I'll give this a special symbol, delta naught. Okay, so climate sensitivity without feedbacks. I think this has a very precise definition, and if you read some of the critiques of global warming theory, they'll say, oh, this is just something that's made up. Well, I think it has a very, for physicists, this is a very precise definition. You talk about constrained variations, and you're very explicit about your constraints, and then it gives you a number that you can think about and use. All right, so let's talk now about feedbacks. So there's no feedbacks here. So what is a feedback? So I'm going to talk about two types. Hopefully I'll have time. So direct feedback and indirect. And I'll talk about water vapor and clouds. And I should say here that I will give you I'll post the slides. I also have some typewritten notes here, and I'll post a bibliography because I'm quoting from a lot of review articles here for anybody who's interested. I'll prepare that after the talk. Okay, so water vapor and clouds. Let's start with water vapor. So what is a feedback? In this very narrow definition of climate sensitivity, it's something that's affected by surface temperature and that is radiatively active, that affects the radiation budget. That's what a climate feedback is. And you can imagine, whether it's positive or negative, that it's going to affect your answer of what the rate of change of temperature is with respect to doubling of CO2. Okay? So let's suppose we want to know something about water vapor. Okay. So let's say we have a model for water vapor. Okay? And it would be something like this, that the water vapor, H2O, is some function, E, of the surface temperature. Simple model, all right? Now, we know through Clausius Clapeyron, standard arguments, that, for example, E prime, okay, the rate of change of E with respect to surface temperature is positive. The warmer the surface is, the warmer the air is, typically the more water vapor it can hold. And there's a lot of ideas behind this, but I'll talk a little bit more about those as we go along. Okay, but the main point for this formalism is just to say that we've introduced a functional dependence between E and surface temperature. Okay, and that means that our water vapor is, when we perturb surface temperature, we're going to go from H2O to H2O plus delta H2O. Okay, and that variation is constrained by this relationship. It's H2O plus E prime times delta TS. Okay? Now, water vapor is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's the most powerful greenhouse gas, and it's very good at trapping radiation. It has a very sensitive dependence on surface temperature. So this E prime will be effectively a big number, and we'll get a lot of feedback, positive feedback from water vapor. Okay? So you can see here, so I just go through the same kind of variational argument there. Okay, and so I'll just say as before, the exercise for the interested participant, that the change in surface temperature, okay, allowing water vapor to vary, I'm putting that as a superscript, so allowing for water vapor feedback, but keeping radiation and everything else except water vapor fixed, is delta naught over 1 minus G H2O, okay. And just to make sure I've got things right, GH2O, this is the gain from water vapor. And it has three terms in it. It has the rate of change of radiation with respect to water vapor. So both shortwave and longwave are affected by water vapor. And we can calculate this using radiative transfer models. E prime, okay, and then divided by the standard Planck scaling here. This is black body again, all right? So that's our water vapor gain. And each of these terms is very, very, very interesting. Right? This is all tied into the circulation. This term might not be so interesting by itself because you just take a radiative transfer model, a long wave and short wave, and you vary H2O, water vapor, and you'll get different answers. But it turns out that this calculation is sensitive. So first of all, this thing is certainly negative. Sine is no problem. But it's sensitive to water vapor in specific places. It's sensitive to water vapor in the upper troposphere, of the tropics. Oops, in the tropical upper troposphere. Okay, so. The calculation isn't so interesting, but the result is very, okay? It turns out that, and you don't need a full GCM to find this out. For current climate conditions, with our distribution of clouds and everything, the effective emission surfaces, where water vapor is important, is up in the tropical upper troposphere. And it's very dry up there. It's cold and dry. So it means that that little part of the atmosphere, okay, is a hot place for global warming. The most intense work on water vapor feedback has focused on what controls the distribution of humidity in the upper troposphere of the tropics. This is also a very interesting quantity here, E prime of TS. Now, there's a lot hidden in that little little combination of symbols. That is asking, what is the dependence of water vapor on the surface temperature? And to get that, you really need GCMs, you need general circulation models of the circulation. You need to figure out things about water vapor transport, how water vapor gets from one place to another. Okay, and given all that, you can get this number. But it turns out that the numbers really, even as models have gotten better and better, these numbers haven't changed very much. Now,
what do you think about the role of ice in scattering?
Well, yeah. So I'm wrapping a lot. I'll talk about clouds in a minute, but there's a huge. Yeah. So there's a lot of literature on that, and this is where I'm not so well qualified. Okay. The key thing about that question though is, if some of the controversy around global warming has swirled around microphysical properties of clouds and how they control the distribution of relative humidity in the tropical upper troposphere. However, it's really hard to change the basic answers. given all the models, I would say the article I'm quoting here is the Helden Soden 2000 review article, which goes through all the possibilities. And I'd say that GH2O, okay, has been pretty well constrained to be about 0.4. The gain is 0.4. Okay. Now, if GH2O were 0, there'd be no feedback. If it were 1 or greater, you would have a runaway greenhouse. Okay, you get amplification of an initial perturbation. But for whatever reason, we're at the 0.4 level, okay, roughly. And this is the consensus estimate based on models and observations. Now, it's really hard to get these numbers from observations. You really need models to pin them down. Okay, so let me just say, see discussion on in Helden Soden, because they go through everything.
So when you write,
yeah,
approximately, what kind of errors?
I would say that the errors on the water vapor feedback are on the order of 20%. I'm guessing. They are not, the big player, as I'll say next, is the clouds. And I'll actually show you a graph. Why don't I show you the graphs from the models, because they'll tell the story in the best way. So can I just show them that question? Okay. Since we're sort of running out of time, let me just say.
Now, you do a linear response theory, but you need the full nonlinear model to get your parameters going into your linear model. So why that exercise? Because if you have your nonlinear model, you just run it and see what is the response.
The quick answer is this ceteris paribus thing. It's like, if everything else is really held fixed, including the circulation, all right? Yes, the circulation is nonlinear and so on, but it's given, it's prescribed, and you can then ask for a given change in a small change in surface temperature. You can go to the model and make an increment, and go through and do all the calculations. There's various ways of calculating that. So it's not saying that the nonlinearity doesn't exist, but these variational state, you have to understand what these terms mean. And this is where physicists can contribute, because they understand what this means. We understand what this means, right? What this derivative means.
Usually you do these kind of linear response when you don't have access.
This is not a I would disagree that this is actually just a linear, because the thing is that if you allow the process to feed, there's various ways of calculating this. You can do it, as I've suggested, by just taking tangent approximations to your model. You can also turn off the water vapor feedback, as Holland and Abbe did. Okay? And there you get a different answer, because then the circulation feedback feeds back. It changes the circulation. If you change, turn off the water vapor feedback, okay, you change El Nino, you change the response to volcanoes, you change everything. This, whereas if you go into the model and you just fix everything except that water vapor term, you learn something else, right? So they're complementary approaches. They all say basically the same thing. I mean, nothing really changes this number that much. This is I'm not saying this is not a strong function of all the parameters, right? This is a strong function.
The word feedback is confusing in this case. As you involve extra variable of H to zero, how it responds in your R equation and so on.
Well, we could talk about that, but you know. I think you just have to, I mean, this is how I've defined the feedback, so, okay, hopefully it's not too confusing. Okay, when we add other feedback, so for example, from clouds, so let's say we had some model to tell us how radio transfer responds to clouds. Okay, so let's say we had this. Now, this quantity is very tricky because clouds, as is well known, have two properties radiatively. High clouds tend to trap thermal radiation, and low clouds tend to reflect it. Okay, so this thing is actually positive for low clouds, and it's negative for high clouds. You can see in my picture that the low clouds were very dim, and that means they're not very important for the long-wave feedback, but they are very important for the short-wave feedback. And the key uncertainty about clouds is really what the low clouds are doing, because the low clouds respond to circulation in a very non-trivial way. Okay, and that comes through here, the CDTS. How do the clouds change when the surface temperature changes? This is really the hard part. The water vapor is not so bad, but this thing can really be very model dependent. So I'll just say model dependent. Okay.
What about mid-clouds?
Well, you know, there's, yeah. Mid-clouds, yeah, I'm focusing on the ones that I think are the key. Yeah, high and mid-clouds are kind of, I don't really know the full answer to that, but it's really the low clouds. In other words, I can take two GCMs and warm them up, and in one model, the low clouds will go away, and the other model, they'll increase, all right? That's a level of uncertainty. It's a sign uncertainty. Mid clouds are kind of, I'm sure they'll be important once they figure out the low clouds. Okay. All right. So, but the main thing about other feedbacks, direct feedbacks, is that the gains are additive. Okay. So if we say, take this guy, allow water vapor and clouds to vary, keeping radiation, everything else fixed. We get delta naught divided by 1 minus g water minus gc. All right, where gc is the water vapor, that is the cloud feedback. Okay, so I promised that I would try to link all three parts of the program together. So what I have is a little thing on.
Gc is at the moment just a knob.
No, it's not a knob. Well, I'll show you those answers.
Unknown.
Okay, it's overall, it turns out to be with the low and high clouds, it's on the positive side, but there's a big spread. I'll show you the graph to finish things off. Okay. I said I would talk about the biosphere, but I really don't have time to do it justice. Okay. But the biospheric feedbacks are very interesting. I think, from my impression from the program, is that the most important biospheric feedbacks are indirect. All right. And the feedbacks on CO2 are probably the most important. Okay, and that goes probably for fire as well as just general biospheric feedbacks. I could be held at issue for this, but I don't think the radiative properties of the vegetation are the key thing. I'm getting a nod from somebody who I can take as an authority. So, okay. Sound right? Okay. So, in other words, it's how vegetation and the biosphere, including in the ocean biology, affect CO2 that's important, not the way they affect temperature directly. So let me take a shot at what this might look like. Let's say we had a model for the vegetation. Okay. Where V was just a function of carbon dioxide and temperature. And we had a model for carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
that depended on emissions, anthropogenic emissions, A, and vegetation, B. Right? So greenhouse warming, greenhouse gas pollution, changes A, but you can imagine a world where V is fixed, okay, and then another world where V is allowed to respond. Vegetation, well, you can imagine how vegetation might depend on CO2. You know, if there's more CO2, there might be more vegetation. That's a fertilization effect. If it's warm, it might be more productive. You'd get more vegetation. Or if it gets too warm, you might lose vegetation. You might die off. Right? So all these different kinds of processes can be captured, at least symbolically. And just cutting to the chase, the indirect feedbacks come in a slightly different way. Okay, they're affecting CO2. So imagine that R is not a function, so it's a function of TS and so on, but not vegetation. So I'm saying that basically we have transparent, radiatively boring plants out there. Okay. If that were the case, you can still write down a feedback, all right? And it looks like this, that the change in temperature will look something like this, delta naught times the change in CO2 from emissions, okay, divided by 1 minus a gain from vegetation on CO2, and another gain involving the temperature feedbacks from the vegetation. So these two things, the key problem right now in global climate and vegetation feedbacks, it's not, this is the change in vegetation for a given amount of CO2, and this is the change, I didn't really write this properly, but GT CO2 is delta naught times the change in carbon dioxide per unit change in vegetation for fixed emissions times the change in vegetation, which is, I'm writing the functional dependence as F, per change in temperature at fixed CO2.
F is V?
F is V, it's just written as a different function, you know, just to separate things out, otherwise it gets very confusing. And all I'm saying here is that, yes, this captures the effect of drawdown of CO2 by vegetation. So this thing is usually negative, right? The more trees there are, the less CO2 there'll be for fixed temperature and everything else. But this guy is the key question, right? So the sign of this depends on whether vegetation grows or dies in response to a warming planet. All right, and that's one of the key questions for fire, for everything. And the nice thing about the feedback analysis is that you can put these guys side by side and say, well, will they cancel? This one's usually a negative feedback. I won't show you that. But this one could have either sign. It could totally outstrip this one. You know? On the whole, most models are showing that the vegetation feedback on climate change is positive, unfortunately. So with our current generation of dynamic vegetation models, we're seeing bad news. Okay, the plants get stressed out by climate change. But I don't know if the analysis at this level has been done, but this is what you have a whole toolkit from the physical climate system to apply to this, and people know that, and they're taking care of that. Okay, do you have a minute more? I can show you some slides, but let me just show you one slide to conclude. I appreciate being able to go over a little bit here. So you'll find right away that I'm lying. More than one slide, but never trust a climate scientist. So, I can skip. This one shows that the total column integrated water vapor in observations and models. The observations are solid, and the model is dashed. Given the surface temperature of the ocean, a GCM can really produce the year-to-year variability in observed water vapor. So this is one vote of confidence in how the models might get water vapor feedback, right? They can just reproduce the observed water vapor variability from year to year. This shows the greenhouse effect.
Prescribed SST.
This shows the greenhouse effect over an El Nino cycle from 85 to 89. okay? The greenhouse trapping, calculated by the observations, satellite observations, the dotted line, and the model simulation, okay? So this shows, and there's a weighting applied to this to account for the interactions between circulation and water vapor feedback. The main point is that models are capable, if you give them the right sea surface temperatures, such as you see during an El Nino, you get warming in the East Pacific, you can get the water vapor feedback that's observed from satellites. Models can really capture this particular effect. Now, and I can basically finish with this slide. This is from a review article by Boni et al., Sandrine Boni, and I showed a figure from that paper that was a cloud figure I showed at the beginning. And this review covers all the physical feedbacks in the climate system that we know about. So it's a good starting point. It's not very pedagogically transparent, but it shows you some good numbers to work with, all right? And it's shown in different units, but basically this is the gain factors from water vapor, clouds, albedo, and that's the sea ice, which I haven't touched at all, sea ice and snow. This LR is actually a circulation feedback. It's called the lapse rate feedback. And it's typically anti-correlated with the water vapor feedback. So it turns out that when you combine the two of them, water vapor and lapse rate, they actually collapses the spread a bit. So the water vapor feedback, you can see here, they're all, and this gets to David's question, there's a spread here, okay? Now,
in terms of G's,
yeah, I know they're different. No, this is these are G's. These are the DRDs. This is the radio gain. So this is
G was one.
This is watts per meter squared, particularly Kelvin. Yeah. So start. This is dimensional. So this is 0.4. This is about 0.2. So the cloud feedback. Okay. Now this figure. This is all the total cloud feedback. Okay, so you can see that there's a lot of spread here, all right, and that there's, I don't know exactly, this is some sort of observational, I'm not quite sure what this is. Oh, this is the standard error associated with some of the calculation methods, that's what this is. But you can see that different papers give a really wide spread in the cloud feedback. But if you take this 0.4, this including the high clouds and not accounting for the low clouds, it's not broken down that way in this particular figure, it's at the 0.2. But if you look at the low cloud spread, it's the one that really it straddles zero. Low cloud is the problem.
There's no problem. Aerosols.
What do you mean no aerosols, sorry?
Aerosols supposed to be negative.
Aerosols give a negative feedback. I forget if this calculations involve the indirect effect of aerosols, but it's yeah. This is primarily aerosol. I don't think there's an aerosol feedback. There might be actually an aerosol feedback in this as well, but it's not going to be the full indirect.
That's a major negative.
So I didn't describe this figure well because let me start with this. These are models from the recent assessment of the UN IPCC that include scenarios for aerosol emissions and pollution, and they simply take the responses in the cloud fields and relate them to temperature and radiation changes. So they do some offline calculations to get this. Those wrap in. They haven't broken out the aerosol feedback, but some of the models include aerosol effects and others don't. And I'm sorry, I don't really have a better saying that. Okay, this albedo is not, this A is cryospheric. It's not aerosols. It's only the sea ice and snow albedo effect, and it's on the order of 0.1, okay? So 0.4, 0.2, 0.1. This is the lapse rate feedback, okay? This brings, the lapse rate feedback tends to be negative and brings the 0.4 down to 0.3 or so. And this is the total. The message from this, why is the total 10 feet greater than all of them? It's because the gains are additive, all right? So, and if they're, the more positive ones they are, the more you're pushed into a higher number. And the climate sensitivity, which is the ratio of 1 over 1 minus F, tends to get pushed higher. This figure, all I want to point out from this figure is that if you actually define the climate sensitivity, this F is my G, okay? If you have a distribution of uncertainties in climate gains, that tends to lead to a skewed distribution. Say you have a symmetric distribution of uncertainties in
the G's,
you tend to get a skewed distribution in climate sensitivity because most of the feedbacks that I've been talking about are positive. So the distribution here tends to have a long tail, and there's a small but finite probability of very large responses to global warming. That's a very robust feature. No matter how we constrain climate feedbacks, you'll always have this behavior, primarily because the water vapor feedback shifts you into that regime of stronger sensitivity. If you had biospheric feedbacks, as John Hart was arguing, those can make things worse. So. Okay, so I think that's all.
Any more questions?
Is there a simple reason why the response to CO2 is lower?
There's enough CO2 in the air that the CO2 is concentrated enough that the saturation long wave, those bands are saturated long wave. And we're very, and that's very robust. We can double, or it certainly it only gets. We couldn't reduce CO2 so much that it would have a long range, which is fortunate. There's a side story. CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. The radiative forcing from chlorofluorocarbons is linear in the concentration. They're extremely potent and dilute. And if we had not had the Montreal protocols and follow-on protocols to inhibit the ozone depleting effects, the projections are that our business as usual with CFCs would have led to, I think, at least half the greenhouse effect from CO2. So we would have had a worse problem dealing with CFCs than we do just with CO2. So this is a very interesting side story. Yes, yeah.
This DFDT, the response of the vegetation to temperature,
yeah.
Could we change the sign of that by growing different crops?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in principle, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of in principle. I think that there was a geoengineering forum here, and I think the thing about geoengineering is that it's really hard. It takes a lot of effort. This is not my original thought. It's actually from James Lovelock's books. And he talks about, just imagine a world where we're the ones who are in charge of the planet. We have to think of crop rotations. I mean, sure, in principle, but is that where we want to be? Is trying to think of huge, large-scale crops and plantings and putting things up in the air to reflect sunlight. Is that where we want to be? So there's a lot of ethical questions.
I live in the opinion that in all these fields were important in terms of activity for stable 35 ocean. Is it true?
The thermal conductivity of a stably stratified ocean?
Yes, so it's important. Four components of this situation. How strong, how weak, how important?
You mean like mixing of the effective mixing, but this is an important process in ocean circulation models. Okay.
How is it important for
the main thing? The rule of thumb that I learned in grad school is that for climate change, okay, the clouds are important for climate sensitivity, and the oceans are important for timing. How fast the system takes to get to equilibrium is determined by ocean mixing and recirculation. So. A lot of the climate delay, we're fortunate in the way that the ocean is nice and deep and takes up heat because we're in a radiative disequilibrium now. And so we don't have as much warming as we might have otherwise to deal with because the ocean is taking a while to warm up. Okay? So I don't know to answer your question except to say that it's important certainly for paleoclimate kind of variations. And I think Paul Williams as well. And I should say, cloud feedbacks were covered very nicely, really well by Ray Pierre Humbert in his talk in our program. So you should be giving his talk.
You talked about this Nigerian oscillation.
Yeah. One thing I didn't say.
No,
not really.
The causes of this
the tropical circulation. Yeah. No, I'm not him. That's Kushner.
The question is whether there is one mold or a couple of models which are capable to reproduce this sort of oscillation.
The extratropical circulations are really well captured in weather forecast models and standard models, but tropical circulations not so well, and an interseasonal variability is not well captured typically in models. You get some of the basic behaviors, but not the full thing. So this is an area of really active research. It's in fact, you know, it's not. I wouldn't say it's quite a crisis, because you might be able to separate the climate problem from the weather, from the shorter timescale problem. But the ability of models to reproduce multiple week variability is not very good, especially for the MJL. So we had some discussion of this in the meeting.
During the conference,
and MIDA
specifically devoted to this subject of oscillation.
Because the problem is that we have a model, and we talked about this model. This just pure mathematical model of this and I have a lot of problems to convince meteorologists that this model is good, because it's too simple. The main idea of me coming here was to get some data, because it's so simple that if we have some data, we can just check it.
Well, we can probably talk about that. And we had a few talks on MJO in our conference. Yeah. Yes.
But why I understand it, you sort of assume or believe that global circulation is not affected that much by
For the sensitivity analysis, no. I don't assume that at all. But the classical theory is based on that say the stratification is given, and then how does the surface temperature change? And you can build up that way. But the actual models as they run, the circulation changes, everything changes, and it's disentangling and understanding what it is, what's going on, is the real key. Because if the cloud response is coupled to circulation, and different models respond, have different types of circulation responses, it's just an impossible task, right? So the models are now at this point able to really realistically simulate the observed climatology and even the past, the 20th century, quite accurately and everything. But really understanding what's going on in them is very difficult. And so this is one handle that you can adjust. One handle into making progress is a really limited feedback analysis. And then you go on to the next thing, and that's how we make progress, because it's still very complicated. But the circulation changes are tend to be not very robust, especially in the extratropics among the different models. And it's one of the areas of active investigation.
Okay, that's
thank you. Okay.